Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Just a few games left in the Men's World Cup. It's been a tournament full of surprises and upsets, but that's not what has gotten my next guest worked up. No, he's been watching for head injuries and how officials handle them, and he hasn't been impressed. Lee Eagle of New York University's Tisch Institute for Global Sports has co-authored an op-ed in Forbes calling on FIFA to do better when it comes to treating possible concussions and preventing long-term brain damage. Lee, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thanks for having me in on the conversation.
We, in this country at least, have heard a lot about football and concussions and also long-term degenerative brain damage from head trauma in that sport. What do we know about these kinds of issues in soccer?
Yeah, in soccer, which the rest of the world, by the way, calls football, head injuries are serious business. We tend not to think of soccer being a sport where there are a lot of head injuries because mostly it's about using your feet and, once in a while, hands. But headers are part of the sport. And concussions also come into play, not only when people head the ball, but when they go up for a header or they're just running around trying to catch up with the ball and knock into each other. So the possibility of head injury is all over the sport. And there's a lot that we've learned in a short period of time about it. And just like all these other sports where your head is at risk for injury, so goes in soccer.
Do we know how frequent concussions or even, as we've heard with football, these subconcussive head injuries, just kind of what we would almost call routine head trauma? Do we know how frequent and pervasive that is in soccer?
Well, it depends who you ask and whose data you look at, because this is one of sort of the tough points, is that when there's a call for concussion, when somebody's been hit in the head, sometimes it's really clear and evident. They're knocked out. They're kind of knocked silly. They're up and wobbling. And we go, okay, well, that's a concussion. Well, first of all, you can miss it because sometimes they go back out on the field and just go, no. They were just, lights out for a little bit, but it wasn't a concussion. And then we've got ones where we don't see it at all. It just doesn't show up. It's not like an injury to bones or muscles or joints. So there's a lot that can be hidden. And to start getting into percentages it's sort of that old line, there are lies, damn lies, and then statistics. That's exactly what happens with concussions and the concussion discussion.
Even before the Men's World Cup started, there was kind of a high-profile case involving the goalie for the Liverpool team where he hit his head kind of early in a game and his performance the rest of the game wasn't what people had expected, and some speculation that maybe that was the result of the hit to the head and maybe that would raise awareness and get people in the soccer community talking about concussions and head injuries. Do you think that the soccer community is getting on board with at least talking about this? It has seemed like the soccer community maybe has lagged a little bit in facing up to the issue of head injuries.
You bring up a lot of points that really get at the issue and why it's so difficult to sift through. The example of the Liverpool goalie is a great one, unfortunately, because it happened in the UEFA Champions League final. So this is for the biggest prize other than the World Cup. And early on in the match, it ended up with some sort of head injury and ended up staying in the game, made some pretty bad errors that cost the team some goals. And there's all sorts of speculation and controversy as to whether he sustained a head injury. He actually went to Boston after and got looked at by some physicians there, and they diagnosed concussion. So it starts to wind into all these different points. One about what happens when a concussion is sustained by a player. Another about what happens when we see players get in the game, because who wouldn't want to stay in the game, especially if it's for the greatest prize? And that's really probably sort of at the heart of things, is it's nice to sit back and talk about what we think people would do and what they should do. It's a whole different story when we get to the game and all of these millions of people watching around the world, and you're up for all the marbles.
I'm talking with Lee Eagle of New York University about concussions and head injuries in soccer. Your op-ed was specifically focusing on the Men's World Cup and one incident in particular that you found pretty egregious. So what happened there?
Yeah, so there was a player from Morocco ended up with a concussion. It looked pretty clear. It actually flubbed the medical treatment from the start. So he went down, players all around him grabbed water bottles, started squirting him in the face with water bottles, and sort of getting him to come to. By the time the medical staff got out there and picked him up, which is another sort of thing we want to look into and see how well they treated him there, they ended up doing something out of the old playbook of sort of, get up, walk it off, rub some dirt on it. They started slapping him in the face, trying to get him to come to. It took him out. He was supposed to sit out for minimum of 6 days, according to FIFA concussion protocols. 5 days later, he was in the team's next match, and he had to wear a protective helmet of sorts. We can get into the discussion about how much helmets prevent concussions. They don't. He put it on 16 minutes into the match. He walked over, tossed it to the sideline, went back out and played. And then, as if that wasn't enough, a few minutes later, went up for a header and got knocked around a little bit on that play. So it's almost from the start, everything that went into the FIFA concussion protocol just sort of went by the wayside.
What do you think drives that kind of response? I mean, there's the player who wants to be in the game, but from the perspective of the medical professionals and the team managers and the league managers, why wouldn't they want these policies enforced?
Well, there's a lot that goes into it. One is certainly the player wants to be out there and in the moment. Tough to think about all the long-term implications, but to make it a little bit tougher on the player, and certainly this is a good case to look at, his coach said, hey, this guy's a warrior. He wanted to go out there. And the team physician said pretty much the same thing, at least about going out there. I felt pressured to put the player out there, including from the player himself, and so it cleared him. I wouldn't do it again in the future. But that brings up an interesting point about team medical staffs, because the pressure there is enormous. If you want to be a part of the team, and you got to get the players out there. It's, again, nice to sit in a room somewhere and have everybody thinking that, hey, of course I do the right thing. I wouldn't go out there. I wouldn't have my player go out there with a concussion or possible head injury. But when the game is on the line, something different happens. And that's really what we're getting to and trying to figure out. What are the best ways to go forward on that, knowing that people tend to think about the short term and act on it much more than they do about the long term? And that's really what this whole concussion crisis is about.
I was going to ask you about various different policies that individual national leagues or professional leagues have put into place and whether those are effective. But it sounds like it almost doesn't matter what the policy is because the policies aren't necessarily being enforced. So is there a solution to this? What needs to change in order to better address concussions and the risk of head injury in soccer?
Like anything in life, you got human beings involved, so nothing's going to be perfect. And to be fair, there are plenty of cases where the concussion protocol across any sport is followed, but not always and almost never enough. So what to do about it? Actually, Art Kaplan and I have been on it for a while about really introducing independent physicians, independent doctors in a number of different ways, but mostly one, to act as a check on the team physician who might feel compromised and just sort of say, did you think about this? Just want to remind you, professional to professional, colleague to colleague, but also to help defray some of the pressure that and maybe some of the blame that might go around at the team physician when the team physician says, I got to take the player out of the game. And here comes the player, coaches, teammates, whomever, saying, get him back in, get him back in, or get her back in. I think independent doctors somewhere in the mix really could help.
Another proposal that you have written about favorably is something that the Premier League has proposed, which is modifying the rules for substituting players. Because, of course, in soccer, there's a limit on how many players you can actually sub out during a game. And so this proposal would kind of take that pressure off of teams and say, hey, if somebody's got a head injury, they can take 10 minutes off the field to be assessed, give everybody, including those doctors, a little bit of time to think about this situation without it penalizing the team. They can have a sub in during that time, and then that sub can become permanent without counting toward the team's substitution limit, if indeed it becomes clear that player with the head injury needs to stay out. Is that kind of proposal making headway?
Yeah, no pun intended. it's actually not. And you look at it on its face and say, well, this seems to make sense. There's sort of no harm, no foul in it. And it's really in everybody's best interest. But officials think this is one of the worst ideas to go around, because what first comes to mind for them is coaches and managers are going to start to abuse this, and they're going to use it as a loophole, as another way to make a substitution. So in English Premier League, while they're definitely concerned about concussions and the Premier League physicians, the club physicians are calling for something like the concussion bins, officials are just like, no.
We have seen in the United States the rules about heading, the minimum age at which kids can head the ball has kind of been rising. It's in the early teens at this point. But, you know, you watch the World Cup and these world-class players are sometimes not only jumping up in the air to head the ball, they're bending over to head the ball when they could potentially use some other part of their body. Heading isn't maybe as essential to soccer as tackling is to football, but it's a pretty big part of the game. Is there any chance that heading could ever be eliminated from soccer?
You know, it's one of those cases where you go tell the people involved in soccer and in international football to not include heading in the game. You know, good luck, because these are parts of the game that are important parts of it. So we've got to figure out ways to not necessarily take these things like tackling and headers out of sport, but to figure out better ways to do it. And that's not just some ivory tower kind of thinking. It's that, you know, one of the things that's popular or gaining popularity in American football is to do rugby style tackling. It's not perfect. And there are plenty of rugby players who, you know, deal with head injuries, but it's a different style of tackling. It's not leading with the head. So it's minimizing or finding different ways to get the head, that part of the head, out of the game.
That's Lee Eagle of New York University's Tisch Institute for Global Sports. Lee, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And that's our show. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.